Let's begin with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Guru, Paramahansa Yoganandaji, Saints of all religions, we humbly bow to you all. O beloved Lord, help guide us from this world of darkness into thy light, from this world of restlessness into thy silence, and into thy everlasting, ever new bliss. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. We'll have some music.
Lord, I called you, my Lord. Lord, I called you. Many years I have longed for your son. With tears of devotion, offered candles in prayer to your light. How much longer, friend, must I cry your name? I am your
begin with the call to go within.
Somehow I'm gripping it. That ought to stir up your chakras. So I thought that I would start this morning by reading one of the recent blogs. For those of you who don't know it, Davy and I do a weekly blog. We alternate, and you can sign up for that through ananda.org. And this was one from 2 weeks ago that has to do with the theme of yesterday. This is kind of a prose poetic rendition of what we were talking about. There was only stillness, a stillness so profound that no words existed to describe it, and bliss, a bliss so fulfilling that nothing more was desired or needed. But the nature of bliss was to expand, ever expand, and so a small part of the still, infinite bliss began to vibrate, and this was the primordial duality, stillness and vibration. The one became many, and different rates of vibration became sound and light and power and joy, peace, calmness, love, and wisdom. These vibrations were called words in the Bible, and Om and Prana in the Vedas. Out of them the universe was formed. That which was farthest from the stillness seemed inert and without awareness. It formed into the mountains and the valleys. Then came the rivers and the seas, the fiery stars, the air, and finally the ether. These elements, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, beget life, which became ever more aware, and finally, self-aware. But at the heart of every atom was the primordial stillness remained, and a yearning to return to the inner bliss. This yearning throbs in all humans, the children of the bliss. The minds of men, which demand words and forms, clothe the creative vibration with different names and images. And even though none of these could begin to hint at the vastness of infinity, they managed to placate the desires of those in a body to worship God with a form. When the yearning to return to the source grew strong, the still bliss manifested as the teachers of men. To some, those who thirsted greatly, these saviors stretched out their hands and offered the living waters of spirit. Others, so parched that their hearts had shriveled, turned away to wander even further into the desert in search of gold and power. But a few, a very few out of millions, yearned to discover the spring from which the holy ones had drawn the desire-quenching water. So the teachers showed them a path, which led not through mountain passes, but through stony hearts and past uneasy minds. The guides taught the seekers how to still the ever-moving breath and quiet the restless thoughts. Gradually, by shunning the gaudy attractions of matter, these seekers became calm again. They began to see an inner light and hear once more the ever-entrancing sound of creation. Then finally, the breath, restless from the moment of birth, became stilled, and they were freed from the prison of flesh and bones. Their multitude of desires became just one, the yearning to return to their ancient home. Then finally, they found again what they had always wanted and always been, everything. A few people asked, I didn't clearly give the title of this book, so if you want to get it, it's called Purana Purusha, Yogi Raj Sri Shama Charan Lahiri, and it's by Ashok Chatterjee. I think you can go on Amazon and just type in Lahiri Mahashaya Chatterjee and this book will come up. And so it's available in India and a couple of places here, but it's available through Amazon if you're interested. So to recap a little bit from yesterday, so we have the still vibration, which is God, or still prana, which is God, and it's intelligent, and it's blissful, and it's ever-existing, and it's ever-aware. And a small part of that stillness becomes vibratory or dynamic or kinetic. And that vibratory stillness, that vibratory prana, creates the universe. And the one, the stillness of unity, through that vibration, because the vibration in and of itself is a dualistic vibration. It has a polarity to it, plus and minus, light and dark, and so on. And so that one still vibration, one stillness in vibration becomes duality, and that duality creates the appearance and the consciousness of separation. Now, there is no real separation, but there is the appearance of it. Just as when we dream at night, there's appearance of separation in the images that come in the dream. But the dream itself is one. And so that restless or kinetic vibration goes out to create the universe, and it also creates us. So our body is formed out of the vibrating prana. And so we could really say that we're not a body, we're simply prana in its kinetic form, in its vibrating form. And that takes on, in fact, a particular way of manifesting in the body. So the prana, when it comes into the body, can be called life force. And that's a valid way of describing it, as long as you don't forget that life force is simply an extension of kinetic vibration. And kinetic vibration is simply a tiny part of still vibration. So as long as you don't think life force is something separate from the creative force, then it's a valid description. The scientists, unfortunately, try to figure out how this comes into vibration without intelligence, without consciousness, and without purpose behind it. And so they have the theory of the Big Bang, which is the explosive power that creates the whole universe. But they have a problem of what happens at the very beginning of the Big Bang. And so they have the concept that they call a singularity. And so all of the matter in the universe has to be brought down to a point that's not just small, but is infinitesimal, that's a singularity, and then it explodes somehow from there. I saw a cartoon one time that someone was testifying at a trial, and the judge was slumped over and sleeping on his desk, and the jurors were all laid back, and they were all asleep, and out of the little mouth of the person testifying was a balloon that said, "And then in the second billionth of a second after creation." And underneath it says, "Unfortunately, Carl Sagan had promised to tell the whole truth." And so if you try to describe this whole process without intelligent causation, you get into a big muddle. And then you can get some highly paid grants to confuse others even more. Anyway, so still vibration becomes dynamic vibration. That comes in and it creates the universe. It creates us. When it comes into us, it creates in a specific way. So as Master said, that in the body, the prana enters through the medulla. As the child is formed, the cells begin at the formation of the medulla. And then the cells multiply from there. And so that prana coming in at the point of creation of our body then multiplies and creates out of the stillness and out of a pattern, it creates us. And then when that prana is in our body, it takes on the different functions. So in Ayurvedic medicine, for instance, they talk about there being five different pranas. Well, it's one prana functioning in five different ways. So prana is respiration and oxygenation, and then there's apana, and that's elimination, and there are different functions, so digestion and circulation and so on. But it's all prana that's forming the body. What it really forms is the duality of the ira and the pingala, and then in the center, the shushumna. That's why Shiva, who represents God beyond creation, or the creative force in part, that which outwardly it's that which dissolves, but the deeper meaning is that dissolves back into stillness. That's why he's shown holding a trident, and that trident is the ira and the pingala and the shushumna, the three tines of that trident. At any rate, so when we come into the body, when we're born, the dynamic prana starts rotating in the ira and the pingala. That is the causative form of the breath. And so we begin breathing. And as long as that prana is vibrating or moving in the ira and the pingala, we continue breathing. At the time of death, that prana again exits. But Master said that it exits at the point that it enters, at the point of the medulla. And when it exits there, it still exits in not its completely quiet form. And when we exit not in the quiet form, then inevitably we are destined to reincarnate. And so what we want to do is during this lifetime, we want to figure out through our practice, through our devotion, through our whole sadhana, through our life, how to get that energy of kinetic prana in the ira and pingala into the shushumna. And as it comes up the shushumna and projects to the kutasta, we see the spiritual eye. And so by concentrating at the point of the spiritual eye, I'm going to talk later about this principle, but wherever our awareness is, wherever our concentration is, it creates like a magnet that draws prana to that point. That's the essence of the energization exercises. So by concentrating here as well as we can, it begins to stimulate the process of interiorizing that energy and bringing it up to the stillness here. And if we can do that completely, it will take all of the kinetic energy of the kundalini, which is like the polarity that keeps it active, it will bring it up and it will unify it with the positive pole and neutralize that kinetic energy. So that stops. It becomes still. And at that point, if the ira and pingala are no longer functioning, what's the result of that? The breathless state. As the result of also that, we exit the body, which is like a prison for us that we can't get beyond until death. And then we break out of this body, but we still have the astral and causal bodies to work with. If consciously we can bring that kinetic energy back into its still state, then we go into samadhi, we go into a consciousness of unity with God, and we achieve what we have been looking for a long time, forever, in creation. Now, also, as that energy comes through the medulla and descends, it not only creates the vibration of the ira and the pingala and the breath, but it also then spreads out and creates the other aspects of consciousness and of the body. So it creates the body, but it also creates the senses. And so the sensory ability of our mind to perceive a world is dependent on prana. And that in Sanskrit is called mon. There are four aspects of the mind. So the kinetic prana creates the mind and creates the four aspects. The sensory mind, the discrimination, which is here, a buddhi, ahankara, or ego here, and chitta, or the consciousness of feeling, perception through feeling, and the likes and dislikes here. So all of that is dependent on the prana being kinetic. When we get the consciousness really stilled, we no longer function through that, call it human mind. We function through pure intuition. And intuition is a different way of perceiving than this kind of building together a map of the world by overlays. And then we've got an overlay for our perception. So coming into the still state allows us to break out of the body, but much more importantly than breaking out of the body, it allows us to consciously stop the cycle of leaving at death through the medulla and therefore having to reincarnate. Master said that if at the time of death, the yogi, through long practice, when the energy, the prana, is now leaving the body, coming up the Sushumna, but it doesn't project forward, it goes out through the medulla. If by long practice in meditation, the yogi can have that prana continue and bend there and go to the still state at the kutasta, then we achieve liberation and we don't have to reincarnate. And so it all works together as one relatively simple system as soon as we have these basic concepts. Now, coming back to this, then the purpose of our spiritual path, one could say the purpose of life itself, is to go from the consciousness of being creatures of kinetic karma to extensions of still karma. But the vast majority of people aren't interested in that. They're enjoying the drama and the circus that is created by the kinetic karma. But then when a person becomes spiritually awakened enough, or as Master said, the agonizing sense of boredom from doing this over and over and over and over and over. Imagine I just said that a billion times and you're like the jury with Carl Sagan. So an agonizing sense of monotony comes in and we want out of this cycle. And when that happens, then we begin to ask the question, how can I find God? We could substitute, how can I find the still state of prana for that, how can I find God? And what follows from that is how Patanjali started his scripture. When we ask that question, then what does he say? Oh, you've asked that question. And now we come to the study of the science of yoga. Yoga is union. Yoga means stilling the prana that allows the union of the apparent extension, the apparent differentiation that's caused by kinetic prana to become unified and to become stilled. So our whole practice, our whole spiritual path is built around trying to still the karma. I'm going to, in just a moment, go through and review our basic four techniques with this in mind. But let me say that it's not just about techniques. Master said that the fastest way to achieve spiritual progress was to keep the consciousness at the point between the eyebrows. You can read that in his writings. One of his disciples, a man who was working in the print shop, decided he'd give that a try. And he kept his consciousness there very strongly for several days. And the life force began to withdraw from his body, and his hands started to become a little bit numb. And he had to go and ask, or I guess he made the decision. He couldn't safely carry on his work as a printer because the life force was withdrawing. Well, for those of us who aren't needing to worry about getting our fingers smashed in a printing press, it's a pretty good thing if we can withdraw the life force from the body. So one practice, and a very, very powerful practice, is to keep your consciousness at the point between the eyebrows as much as possible. I've been doing that now for several months, and it's a wonderful practice. Not that I can keep it there all the time, because as Davey was saying yesterday, one of the primary obstacles on the spiritual path is forgetfulness. You're trying to do that, and all of a sudden your attention goes to one of those feathers that have flown away, you remember? And you're looking over there, you forget to do it again. But as much as you can trying to do it, what I have found by doing that is that it's not as if I'm seeing the spiritual eye, but there is a constant sense of light at the kutasta. It's not as if I'm looking at a light all the time, but you know, if you're in like a dark cathedral and up at kind of the right level, there's one of those big windows, round windows that they put in the cathedrals, and that's letting in the light. You don't have to be looking directly at it. In that dark room, you have a sense that there's always light coming from that area. So the more you kind of practice looking up toward that window, which is here, the spiritual eye, the more a sensation of light will begin to come there. And the sensation, I don't even know how to describe it, but it's like a sensation of the presence of a sacred vibration. And that's there. I'm one of those people who wakes up several times in the night, and it's more easily practiced then because my mind is not all scattered. And so when I start to go back to sleep, I don't just try to go back to sleep, I try to visualize or feel the light there and feel like I'm going into that. I can just attest, I certainly have not achieved complete victory at this, but I can attest from personal practice that it is a very, very powerful technique for keeping you connected with the goal of life, with God, with Master, because I also visualize Master being there. Okay, let me review now a little bit the four primary techniques that we have and how they work with still prana and dynamic prana. Okay, let's start with energization. Master said that that was his unique contribution to the spiritual path. And so we have learned when we do the energization that what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to tense and relax various parts of the body. And as we do that, we are supposed to feel, or if we can't feel, visualize that a flow of energy is coming from the medulla to that part of the body. And so what we're doing is we're taking the source, or we're plugged in to the universal prana, where our body is plugged into that, and we're sending that under our conscious control. And this is very important. Under our conscious control, we're sending that to a particular part of the body. Now, it's going to go to that part of the body, whether we're conscious of it or not. And in fact, this prana is moving, these vital forces are moving. We couldn't sustain life. We think that we're the cause of our sustaining life because you drink a smoothie with algae in it in the morning. When in fact that basically has almost nothing at all to do with sustaining life. The prana sustains our life. It's going there automatically, so automatically that if you try not to have it continue, it's going to render you unconscious so that you don't have your will involved anymore, and then it's going to start up again. So now what we're doing is intervening with that. It's flowing already. If I'm tensing my hand and forearm, it's already in my hand and forearm. Otherwise, there wouldn't be circulation. There wouldn't be cellular function. There would be none of that going on. It's already there. But I'm adding the ability to further enhance that functioning there by sending the prana under my will to that part. And so by combining your attention and your will and sending it to that part, you enhance or create more prana than was there when you were not conscious of it. How much more? Many times more. Master said that we can go out, for instance, and sunbathe. The sun is pouring prana to us all of the time. We can go out and sunbathe unconsciously, and we'll receive that prana. But if we're conscious of drawing it, he said we can receive 10 times as much prana as we would just being unconscious. So the addition of our consciousness and our will to sending and then relaxing and withdrawing that prana teaches us through the energization to bring the dynamic prana under our control. Now, why is that important? Because in order to achieve enlightenment, in order to achieve moksha, we now have to take that dynamic prana and we have to bring it under the control of our will. Within, we have to begin to close down, relax and withdraw that prana, bring it back, and bring it into the Sushumna, not the restless Ira and Pingala, and bring it up and focus it at the point between the eyebrows. Now, how are you ever going to do that, to direct the prana there, without learning first to direct the prana anyway? It's like asking a person to play the piano without ever telling him that there are notes or fingers or a stool or a piano. Just somehow vaguely you're supposed to do that. So Master is giving us the stepping stones to bring that prana under the control of our will. And what does he say about that prana? He says the stronger the will he defined as desire plus energy. So if we're sending energy to our forearm, first we have to want to send it there. That's the desire. And then we send that energy. And so the stronger the will, the stronger the flow of energy. So he's teaching us not only to direct the will, but how to increase the flow of that. And so then when we begin to meditate, having practiced the energization exercises, we already have, 90% of the battle? We've already been practicing it because we've been practicing how to direct the will and how to increase its flow so that it's dynamic. And so those people who say, oh, I kind of don't practice the energization exercises because I go to the gym and I can get strong enough at the gym, or I run, I don't need to practice energization, or I'm too lazy to practice energization, or I forgot, you know. Well, if you want to try to walk around on your knees instead of your feet, then don't do the energization. But if you want to do what you can to really get to the point where you're free from the reincarnational cycle to achieve moksha, then do what the guru has given us. We had something that was very, very interesting yesterday. We get this newsletter from the Anandamoyi Ma organization through Mangalananda, if you know him. And almost always, I've gotten it for years, almost always it starts out with a story of someone recounting personal incidents of time with Ma. But yesterday, the whole thing was about prana. And doing, she recommends one of the practices very strongly, that you do mantra or that you do chanting and think of God so that your consciousness is turned to God. But yesterday she was saying it's even more effective if you do it in relationship to the breath. And so that if you are doing a chant, and she talked in fact about Hong Saw, if you're doing that, do it with the breath. And so the whole article, it was like Ma saying, I want to join in. Let me be part of that class too. And so it's like the grace of God just flows. As she said when Nalini and I and a couple of others were there, don't you see that the blessings of God are always flowing down? It's like the sunlight, it's always flowing down. And so that was when we asked her to bless a bundle of malas and things from Ananda. She said, don't you see that God's blessings are always flowing down? Why do you ask this body to bless those things? We said, yes, Ma, we understand, but could you also? And she kind of laughed and then blessed them. But there's a connection. She's part of this. In fact, I'll stop and tell a story of someone who, this was told to us by Mangalananda, by people that he knew personally and who told him the story personally. So it's not one of those kind of apocryphal things that goes eight people down the road and then it's a beautiful story, but you don't know the veracity. These were long, long time devotees of Ma, and at the time that she passed away, they were quite distraught. And so they came and they were staying, I think it was in the Hardwar ashram, but I'm not sure. At any rate, they were staying in one of the ashrams that Ma had lived in. And after several days, this was almost immediately after Ma's passing, after several days, they were awakened by this light coming on in the room, and they saw Ma walking through the room, and she paused when she got to the doorway and looked back at them. And then she continued down the steps, and they got up, quickly dressed, and they ran down and followed her. And she went out, and she went to where there was a mandir, and she knelt down and was sat down and was meditating. And they were looking at her, watching her, standing together, when between them, as if through them, because they were standing too close together for a person to pass between them physically, as if through them came Babaji. And they said Babaji was dressed in blue, which I find very interesting. Babaji went behind Anandamoyi Ma, who was then meditating, and he placed his hands on her shoulders. And as he did that, an enormous beam of light went up from the two of them combined and went up into the cosmos. And after some time, then he withdrew his hands and then everything evaporated or dissolved and was no longer there. But very, very interesting. Master went to visit her. There's a connection between her and our particular path. At any rate, that's a little diversion. So I was talking about energization and how important they are in order to help us achieve the goal of bringing the restless prana into a state of stillness. The next technique that we do is Hong Saw. Now, Hong Saw, I don't need to talk about very much, because it is self-explanatory about what we're trying to do here. When we do Hong Saw, we concentrate first at the flow of air in the nose and try to feel it higher and higher toward the kutasta. And eventually we try to feel that all of the flow of the prana that comes in through the breath is focused here. Now we focus outwardly on the breath, because if the technique said focus on the flow of prana through the ira and the pingala, how many of us here could actually do that? We can't. So it says focus on the outward breath, because the outward breath and the ira and pingala flow are connected. And so we focus on that, and we bring that consciousness of the flow of kinetic prana to this kutasta. And we do that as deeply as we can, and we combine that with Hong Saw, which is a bija mantra that is meant to still the flow of prana in the ira and the pingala, and to bring it into the shushumna. So that technique is not obscure at all. It is a kind of a encapsulation and a condensation of exactly what we should be doing. Now, a third technique that we have kind of in our teaching course is Om, but Om is a little bit separate. I'll come back to Om. We give it in discipleship because we want people to prepare their consciousness to keep drawing the consciousness inwardly. And so listening to Om is listening to the vibration of the kinetic form of prana. And as Bharat's book talks about it, as Om is the projection of love, because it's not only bliss that's projected, but it's love. It's the song of love that's projected. And by listening to that, it begins to dissolve the outward manifestation and bring it more and more inwardly. I'll come back to that in a minute. Then, so we've got energization, and we've got Hong Saw, and then we've got Kriya. And Kriya is specifically, and as I was talking yesterday, the most central of all the techniques that have been given to mankind to gain control over restless or kinetic prana and bring it into the shushumna. So even though we're using a breathing technique, and as long as the outer breath is going, there is a movement of energy in the ira and pingala. Even though we're doing that, we're trying to, by visualization, by feeling, we're trying to bring it into the shushumna. And especially at the end, through Jyoti Mudra, we're trying to bring the focus completely into the kutasta, the energy completely focused at the spiritual eye. Now, it is the most central of the techniques of bringing that energy inwardly. And by magnetism, remember, wherever our attention is, that's where the prana flows. So if you want the attention to be, if you want the prana to be inward, then you put your will and your attention inwardly. If you want the prana to be outward, then you put your attention outward to the world and to the things around you. And so in Kriya, to the extent that we can, our whole consciousness, our whole attention, all of our will should be on internalizing the energy and bringing it here. And Lahiri said that Kriya is the solution for all of the problems. Why? Because everything that we think of as a problem comes because we have an ego. Who else is the problem occurring to, if not to us? Or our reactions to it. And why do we have an ego? Because the prana has become kinetic, and as part of the kinetic flow, it creates a mind that has as its one of its components, ahankara, or ego. And so We can't get rid of the ego by using the ego to say, I'm going to get rid of you. We have to use something else. What do we use? We use the ability to pull the plug on the energy that keeps the ego functioning. And that's the practice of Kriya Yoga. So the solution to every problem is Kriya Yoga, is what Lahiri said. And it's hard to tell that to somebody who's concentrated way out there and thinks that their happiness comes through whether the stock market goes up or down today, and to tell them the solution to that is to practice Kriya, they wonder if you're giving them a magic formula for a new investing technique. But it's a little different than that. So if the goal of life, the goal of sadhana, is to bring prana in and up and into its still form, reunite it once again with its still form, then Kriya is the way to do that. Now, Swami was careful to point out that when we go into the still form of prana, or when we leave this body and leave this ego, we do not cease to exist. Because one of the anxieties or fears, as Devi was talking about yesterday, is that if we do this technique, I'm going to cease to exist. And all the things that I hold precious, they're going to cease to exist too. That's part of the dialogue with Arjuna and Krishna in the early part of the Gita. That's why he says, I better not meditate because I don't want to kill all my relatives, my cousins, my beloved teacher, my grandfather, all of these people. I don't want to kill those off. All of those, Master explains, are us reluctant to kill off our tendencies because we equate our existence with our tendencies and our attitudes and our past and our history and our memories and all of that. We aren't that. 99% of us is already the still form of prana. We just have 1% that's activating and running around in the squirrel cage. And we think if it stops running around in the squirrel cage and ceases that activity, that it's no longer going to exist. Well, we're going to go on existing. That which exists can never cease to exist, Krishna says. And so when we go into the still form, we do not cease to be an I. There's still the sense of I am. That I am expands. And so as Master put it so beautifully, I, the cosmic sea, watched the little ego floating in me. And so we become the whole of everything. And yes, we can watch the little ego, which is the little kinetic form. If it's still got a duty to be in this world, then it's going to be in this world. We can watch it, but in that still state, we don't lose anything, we gain everything. And so that's the goal of what we're after. So the practice of all of these techniques, finally Om, because listening to Om, if we internalize that, and if we really can get behind that vibration that creates the kinetic form, then that kinetic form dissolves. And I don't know whether it was Lahiri. I think Lahiri at one point said that man's only duty is listening to Om. Man's only duty is dissolving the kinetic activity of prana. Kriya is the solution to everything. So coming to the stillness. Now, if during our lifetime we practice these techniques and we bring prana under our control and we're able to still the breath and bring the concentration here and we're able to actually bring the energy in so much that we achieve the state of pranayama and that internal state shuts off the sense telephones, the state of pratyahara, and we're able to concentrate deeply here, then what happens at the time of death? When the energy begins to withdraw, instead of it unconsciously leaving at the medulla, it bends, it goes forward, and it reunites with the still state, and we are then released from bondage. We're released from the necessity to incarnate. Now we may, as Ananda Moy Ma said, we may still incarnate a few more times because we've got some past karma to pay off, but we've pulled the plug on the fan and it's just kind of winding down. And so that pranic plug has been pulled, and we might still have a few revolutions of the fan winding down because we have to clean up some past messes of consciousness, and then we're completely free. So if we achieve this first state, we are Jivan Muktas. And Swami said that that means freed while living. Everyone here should aspire to that state. That's why Devi was telling the story yesterday about, I said to her, well, you'd better expect it and then have plan B. She didn't tell the rest of the story, which I'm going to tell now. We were then some time later, a year or two later, we were in Seattle giving a Sunday service, and Devi mentioned that, and then went on to finish the Sunday service. And I got up and I said, for those of you who may not know me, since we don't visit all that often, for those of you who may not know me, I'm Plan B. And so, while it's humorous, it's also serious. What that means is, if we don't achieve the ability in this lifetime to get into the completely still state, and if at the time of death we don't exit through the kutasta, but we exit through the medulla, at least let's have plan B, which is the flow of our desires is to reincarnate in such a way that we are protected by spiritual people, by spiritual thoughts, that we're connected with the guru, that we come in to the next lifetime continuing the momentum of the desire for freedom that we have in this lifetime. So that's your plan B. Your plan C, and down to the rest of the alphabet, I'm not going to go. You can imagine those for yourself. But if you have any desire other than spiritual progress, finding God, and achieving liberation, that's C through Z. And you're going to achieve those. So whatever they are, whatever your other plans are, you get to achieve it. And that's why we have to come back time and time again. Okay, so now we've kind of gone through, but you can go through for yourself. It's one thing to talk outwardly, but it would be very, very good for you to review your own practice of each of the techniques and see internally how they relate to this kind of fundamental equation of moksha, union with God, freedom, spiritual freedom, equals stillness of prana. And how in your own practice do you get there? Now, you have to also be real. It isn't enough to say, oh, the goal is to be completely still in the prana, and you're not even meditating. Then your goal is to meditate. And if you're meditating, then your goal is to meditate a little more and a little deeper. As Swami said to Devi and me, when we asked him, we were kind of grousing about the fact that it seems to take so long. He said that the whole of the spiritual path is to overcome the ego. And that is done, and I assume this is general advice, and not only to us, that is done by longer, deeper meditations, and by seeing that God is the doer in everything. Now, how do you see that God is the doer in everything? When the energy is kinetic and your energy is outward, all you can do is affirm that God is the doer in everything. Yes, God is willow, and willow does things, but it's really, let me remember, oh yeah, it's really God that's in willow that's doing those things. When I do something, I've got to remember that it's not me, it's not the ego, it's not ahankara, it's not the dhamma, it's God who's, you know, and you can approach it, you're trying for it, and that alone is good. But the real understanding that God is the doer is when you go from duality to unity, and then who else could possibly be doing anything? And that's what Lahiri was like. When somebody came and said, can you heal my friend? Lahiri said, I don't have any healing powers. I can't heal anybody. And then the person rephrased it and said, can God through you heal? Oh, well, that's a different question entirely. Of course, God can do it. I'll tell you one quick story. I've got to end and give Devi some time here. But one quick story of Lahiri and healing. Lahiri had two sons and three daughters. And at one point, one of the daughters, the middle daughter, got very ill with Asiatic cholera. And she was married at the time and living in the household of her husband. So Lahiri's wife came to him and said, please, our daughter is at a very serious state. Can you give me something that will help heal her? And so Lahiri instructed her to take a certain kind of a nut and add three peppercorns and grind that together and give that to the daughter. Well, when Lahiri's wife went there, because the family of the daughter's husband was into Western medicine, they were working with doctors, and the mother was afraid to tell them, forget that, I've got a cure here, which is three peppercorns and a nut ground up. And so it was just too hard, and so she didn't do that. And the daughter died. And so that evening, Lahiri came and was continuing his class as usual. And the students, the few students who were in the class said, oh, please, Lahiri, you don't have to continue tonight. He said, no, let's continue. And they said, well, aren't you upset about your daughter's passing? He said, well, let's continue the class. Then they said, well, we're too upset. And we can't pay attention. And so Lahiri said, well, then, okay, then we won't have class tonight. And then one of them asked, doesn't it affect you that your daughter died today? And Lahiri said, let me explain it this way. When you have a piece of marble, and that marble takes a big blow, but it's sitting on another piece of marble. If you pick up the first piece, you don't see a dent in the second marble. But if you take that first piece of marble and you put it on soft clay and you hit the big blow, then you pick it up, you see an impression in the soft clay. He said, I have received a big blow, bigger than what you have received, but my mind is like the marble. It doesn't receive impressions in the same way as you do from the world around you. Yours is like soft clay, and that remains. And so when we go into these exalted states, it also conveys to us the power to function in this world in ways that we cannot even imagine from an egoic standpoint. So, once again, as Lahiri said, and I will end with this, Kriya is the solution to everything.
This is an excerpt from Swamiji reading from Essence of the Bhagavad Gita.
6:32. O Arjuna, the best yogi is he who feels the needs of others, their sorrows, their joys, as though these were his own. 6:33. Arjuna said, O Madhusudana Krishna, owing to my restlessness, I've achieved no lasting results in the attempts you've taught me to steady the mind. 6:34. Verily, Arjuna continued, the mind is restless, tumultuous, madly stubborn. O Krishna, I consider it to be as difficult as to master the wind. Consider how in Autobiography of a Yogi, Paramhansa Yogananda, as a disciple in his guru's ashram, said one day of his meditative efforts, my disobedient thoughts scattered like birds before the hunter. That was the very day his guru gave him his first experience in cosmic consciousness. It is common to lament the slowness and difficulty of one's spiritual efforts. Heroic courage is needed to win in this most challenging, but also quintessentially important of all struggles. Many devotees, after a little effort, flee the scene, returning to the life they lived before. Incarnation after incarnation, they try, fail, then return. Perhaps they return with renewed will to try again, but often they struggle against discouragement and disappointment. A common lament is, but it's so difficult. Well, of course it is. Can the pearl of great price be won without serious effort? Yet there simply is no alternative. Whoever puts his hand to the plow must finish the job, as Jesus Christ put it in Luke 9:62, not looking back, or he won't be fit for the kingdom of God. Let him tell himself that even in the effort to succeed, he is already among the elect of mankind. Few, indeed very few, have acquired the good karma to know that finding God is the only goal of life.
Thank you. I thought we needed Swami's encouragement here. So what I'm going to share now is attitudes that we can all work with to deepen our meditation. And most of us, hi, Kathy, most of us have been practicing and we've reviewed the techniques over and over. But as I began thinking about this subject and reading what Master and Swamiji have said, I think a new image, a new paradigm began coming into my mind of how we can approach meditation that I hope will be helpful for you. It was very helpful for me. First of all, 4 points I want to touch on. The first one is if we want to transcend the ego in meditation, we have to approach meditation not from an egoic point of view. And what does that mean? It means we can't think, I am meditating, I am making an effort, I am making progress, or I am not making progress. But we need to see meditation. Yoga, after all, we all know this, means union. So we need to approach meditation from an egoic, transcendent place. I'm not doing this, but God is doing it through me. So if we approach meditation from the point of view of it's the meeting point between our consciousness, our effort, and God's effort on our behalf, it's that point where they touch. That's what meditation should be. And if we practice meditation in that way, we are already on our way to breaking out of ego. So it was like a revelation to me when I thought of that, not to think I am doing this, but I am sitting here to allow God to make his presence felt, to guide me in my practice of the techniques. Because after all, we need to understand, we touched on this yesterday, the guru is not here to give us things to do, merely to discipline us, merely to show us our mistakes, even merely to work out our karma for us, as powerful as that thought is. The guru is God within us, guiding our thoughts, guiding our perceptions, guiding our practice of kriya. How many of us have been to innumerable kriya initiations, and you watch new people get the technique, you watch new people learn and get a little bit confused in the beginning, asking the same questions that we asked when we first got it. But how do we even have the ability, when we do energization, when we do all the techniques that Jyotish was going through in a very profound way, how do we even have the ability to do that? It's not us. How could our conscious mind do that? It's not our personalities and our egos. It's the power of God's consciousness flowing through us. So to approach meditation as the getting yourself out of the way and say, God is meditating in this room, in this chair, this morning, this evening, whenever it might be, when we're concentrating at the kutasa throughout the day, God is doing that. And the more we can do that, the more the ego begins to dissolve. Remember I said yesterday, in the early days of Ananda, there were several people here who, and I meditated with some of them, and would meditate 6, 7, 8 hours every single day. But you'd get up from meditating with them, and what I would feel, and I was new on the path, I didn't know any better, how spiritual we are. It was about us. It was about the ego. But on the other hand, Swami often praised members of the community who didn't meditate so much, but who gave their life in devotion and service to God and Guru. And those are the people you see now that are shining. Well, if we, not to say we don't need to meditate at this stage in our life, it's extremely important, but to bring that same sense of lack of self-importance, we're just here and we're doing our best to find God. And when we sit to meditate, give it our all. But again, remembering what we're trying to do in every meditation, why not? It's possible to make that point of contact, of dynamic awareness, where we feel my own but God-given power to meditate, to seek God, to practice these techniques. And the more we can do that, the more our depth and our ability to break through to subtler and subtler levels of awareness will be ours. Now, yesterday also, Jyotish was talking about the four paths of yoga and how Lahiri interpreted them in a deeper way. And I'd like to, so this is the second point I want to touch on. I'd like to look at the four paths of yoga as applied to deepening our meditation. So first, of course, is karma yoga. And Lahiri explained, in the most profound sense, that's the practice of kriya. And Devarshi sent us a very interesting little passage that someone had sent him. Devarshi is a wealth of sort of esoteric information about kriya that people sent him all this. But the root of the Sanskrit root of kriya, you know, it says in the autobiography, it means to act. But actually, it has a subtler meaning. Kriya means that action which ends all action, whereas karma means that action which propitiates more action. But in this context, I would like to, for us to deepen our meditation, let's think about meditation as action, albeit, could you get me water? Thank you. Yeah. albeit it may be the action that ends all action. But I think we've all been in group meditations, and you start, you know, you open your eyes and you see the nodders, you know, the people that are asleep and sort of full, bending over. And then I often ask myself, if they were cooking, if they were plowing a field, if they were driving a big piece of equipment, if they were registering people at the master's market, would they be falling asleep? I don't think so. And so we need to build, make meditation a dynamic state with the same sense of action as we would bring to something outward. But that's the subtle thing, because when we close our eyes, when we shut off the senses, it's so easy to go into the subconscious state. But when we sit to meditate, to summon up that, this is action, this is my job, this is what I came into life to do, to bring that same focus as though you were performing a critical action that needed all your attention. And so to deepen our meditation, we need to make it dynamically aware. This is karma yoga. This is what I'm doing. I go and then I do other things in life and I attend to things that God has given me to do, but with that same focus of energy in meditation, with that same dynamic awareness. So karma yoga. And then bhakti yoga. Remember, Jyotish was saying yesterday that Lahiri's explanation of bhakti was when not just worshiping and worshiping outward forms, but when that energy is so one-pointed at the kutasta that the heart opens naturally. And so in meditation, it's not enough just to look at the guru's picture and send love, to look at an image of Divine Mother and send love. We have to go deeper than that. When the love becomes so centralized, we become love. That's the story that Swami would tell us about the devotee who was sitting there throwing flowers on the image of his guru. And then at a certain point, he had such a profound realization and he began throwing them on his own head. And he said, I, the cosmic self untouched by this body or personality, is that which I have been worshiping. It's not that we worship ourselves, obviously, but we become love. We sit there and immerse ourselves in that vibration. I can't even say I had begun the spiritual path yet. I think it was about a month before someone had given me Autobiography of a Yogi. So this was early spring of 1969. I was living, finishing up college in Madison, Wisconsin. And I remember sitting in a little apartment I was sharing with some roommates, sitting alone one day in a nice, sunny living room. And I went into a reverie. And I began thinking what a fortunate life I had had and all the people in my life that had been sources of love for me, parents and relatives and brother and cousins and teachers and friends. And I somehow it kept getting bigger and bigger. And then finally, it was as though Divine Mother or Master were preparing me to receive the autobiography. And I realized that I had always been surrounded in love, and it wasn't dependent on the individuals, that I just always had been, and in fact, that's what I was. And I looked at my watch, and actually several hours had gone by, but it was like that moment of realizing that's who I am, and that's who we all are. We are love. And so to go deeper into meditation, when you feel love for the guru, when you feel love for Swamiji, and to don't let it stop there, because in that, even that sense of longing, it's the first step, but it's not the final step. The final step is when the longing is no longer there, because there's a sense of all that there is love, and I am a part of that. So to go deep in meditation in that experience. And then jnana yoga. Jyotish forgot to mention this yesterday, and so I'll pick up the stitch. What Lahiri said about jnana yoga was that when we hold Jnana Yoga, the yoga of discrimination and analytical processes, that this isn't reality and this isn't reality, and finally you center in on what is, which is God. But what Lahiri says is that when you raise the energy up and concentrate at the spiritual eye, it isn't just jnana, but it's truth. You become one with truth. And to, just as you can rest in love, to rest in that truth. Let it permeate your thoughts, permeate your perception. You know, we try so hard as devotees to have the right attitude and, oh, I shouldn't act that way, I shouldn't think this way, I shouldn't react towards that person in that such a way. But if we're bathed in truth, we don't have to fight all those little skirmishes, because when we rest in truth, the consciousness automatically sees the world from a divine perspective. And so, and it should define our daily life. It should define how all of our actions, that resting in truth. And then we don't have to, we don't have to fight the little skirmishes. One of the things I enjoy so much, it's more than enjoy, that brings me such deep inspiration, is watching all of my guru bhais as the years go by. It's, you know, Swami said that this community, spiritual community life, is like throwing a lot of rocks in a tumbler, and and all the little rough edges get knocked off and they become smooth and beautiful. Well, watching all my guru bhais, and I mean this sincerely, it's a source of unending inspiration for me to see how people are transformed and all the little funny personality kinks and reactive processes and prejudices and likes and dislikes, they just melt away. They're just not so, they don't have such a strong grip on us. This person did a wrong thing to me and I'm going to get back at that person. We could spend our whole life that way, but we're not going to find God. And if you want to find God, then how much better just to rest in the truth of God's greater reality, where we see everyone as a part of a greater whole. It's not that we're naive and we don't see mistakes or things that shouldn't have happened, but it, like the image of Lahiri, such an important one, yes, we see it, but it leaves no impression. We move forward. And that is, as Hamlet said, a consummation devoutly to be wished. To just move through life, whatever blows are ours to take, but because our consciousness is rooted in the eternity of truth, we move forward without having deep impressions and reactive processes infuse our life. And then finally, Raja Yoga, which is the blend of all of them. And this is important in our meditation. It's, Lahiri said that Raja Yoga is the movement, of the practice of all the techniques that enable us to hold our consciousness there. But I would like us to consider Raja Yoga, kingly yoga. We were, just as a little humorous aside, we were playing with a Russian translation program on the computer some years ago to see if we could use it to translate emails from Russian that we would get at the Sangha office. And so we did some tests and we typed in Raja Yoga to see what it would say. And they translated as Tsarist Yoga. So it's not Tsarist Yoga. But if we are able to rest in, to first karma yoga, dynamically bring our focus in meditation, rest and immerse ourselves in love, in truth, to bring our awareness to a high superconscious place, then, and this is the important thing, to build a bridge from that state to our conscious, active life. And so There isn't a dichotomy. Oh, I've got to go and do so many things, and how can I meditate? We carry with us that thread. And in everything we do, we try to refer it back to the superconscious state. And if we do that more and more, then that bridge becomes something we're easily able to span. And it isn't like, oh, okay, here I am. I had a lovely meditation, but now I'm all in a tizzy because so-and-so didn't do something or other, or did something or other, whatever it might be. But if we can build a bridge. One thing that we try to do is when we get up from meditation, to do little things that are simple, that like making the bed, putting away laundry, making breakfast, and keep our mind in that uplifted state where our conscious mind doesn't have to be so busy yet, and then try to keep extending that further and further into the day and into our activities. And then when we pick up meditation again, we haven't really left it. We've always been there, and we can go deeper. And then, you know, it's a wonderful building, expanding circle, that the more when we go deeper in meditation, we're able to carry that on into daily life. When we carry that on into daily life, we're able to quickly go deep in meditation. So it's so helpful to think of these things. Swami also stressed the importance of trying to hold on to the experience when we break through to new thresholds in meditation. So when you're meditating and all of a sudden you feel peace, you feel oneness with that love, you feel oneness with that truth, don't just jump up and say, wow, I had a good meditation. Remember, God's meditating through you. He may have something far more to give you. But if you're thinking, this is my call, this is my choice, I'm done, my time's up, make this your first priority. Remember, Swami told the story, I can't remember if it's written down, but when they were building Encinitas and they were pushing against an opening date and they were behind schedule and they were trying to get those columns done in Master's lifetime with the lotuses on top, there was one man who was in charge of the project, and it was the final day they had to finish that project, and he didn't show up to lead the crew. And so they were scrambling and trying to get it done. Finally, he showed up several hours later. Master was there waiting, and he said, where were you? And he said, Master, I was meditating. But he was truly having a deep breakthrough meditation. Master said, oh, okay, that's good. That was more important. So look for those breaking through to new thresholds. Don't always think, well, okay, I do Hung Sa and this is what happens. I do Kriya and this is what happens. Expect the unexpected. Expect God to come any moment. And then, as Swamiji said, and then make a dash for the infinite. So look for the breakthrough moments. Look for the new thresholds and make them dynamic to your awareness. Don't just say, oh, something happened then. Say, what happened and what did I experience and how do I retrace my steps and how do I magnetically draw God to help me experience this again? And then finally, we've been talking about setting the goal of becoming a Jivan Mukta in this lifetime. Well, we all know that many of us, every year at New Year's, we write our goals down. And when you look at them year after year after year, it's a little embarrassing because they're always the same. And don't I ever change? And then, you know, let's say you say, I'm going to meditate every day at noon, and then you go on a trip and there's no way you can meditate at noon, so you abandon that goal. But if we can not set the goal as specific things, I'm going to do this and this and this, and then when I don't, I throw the whole thing up in the air, but set the goal as an inner goal. My inner goal is to find freedom in this life, and every choice I make, every word I speak, every reaction that I have, I will try to let that support my goal. And so if it's, you know, you feel the tendency to step out of that divine truth that you felt in meditation, step out of the bubble of encompassing love, remember, you can do it. Of course you can. We all do it all the time. But then when you sit to meditate, it creates a ripple in the consciousness, and you can't go deep. And so all of our actions, all of our thoughts need to support the inner goal. And then it all comes together in a beautiful whole. God has been doing this through us throughout this lifetime, probably many lifetimes. And now he's calling us home. And we can do it with the gifts and the teachings, the spiritual support of community, and most of all, the grace of Guru. And we'll talk about that more tomorrow. But some years ago, Swamiji gave out as a Christmas gift a print of a photo he had taken. Beautiful clouds with the sun, beautiful lighting on it. And the quote, this was a quote from one of his books, The Secrets of Meditation. And we framed that and we have it in our meditation room. And it says simply, "The secret of meditation is to pray with deep faith, not as an outsider to heaven, but one whose true eternal home is heaven." So to deepen our meditation, let's start from the point of view that God is doing it, he's calling us home, and all we need to do is let go of all the things that we hold up against that dynamic pull to bring us home. Let them go and say, "Lord, I'm ready now." God bless you.
See you.